1,378 large pages add up to be the Mayo Clinic Family Health Book. And it says across the top, the ultimate illustrated home medical reference. And it's funny, you know, I read that, I think, I wonder if they're going to come out with the new revised ultimate illustrated home medical reference. Anyway, it's a fascinating book with lots of good things and interesting things to read. I have to limit my own time reading it because I find that I look something up and then I turn to another section, I read another section, I look at a picture, and then I cross-reference it, and I spend too much time. So I have to be careful that I don't waste time. And then the other thing is that I assume that I have everything in here. And that gets discouraging when you have almost 1,400 pages of sicknesses that are here. Many of the sections are set up pretty much alike. And they have a major topic, and then they'll list the symptoms and the diagnosis, the prognosis, that's what's going to happen, and the treatment. So I've picked some examples here. Like on page 457 is contact dermatitis. And the symptoms are itchy rash consisting of small bumps, blisters, and general swelling. And then poison ivy is listed as the main example of a cause of this, and it says that the rash develops in as little as a few hours, that it peaks after 5 days, and there really isn't a whole lot you can do to take care of it except make people feel more comfortable, and that typically it goes away in 1 or 2 weeks. And I was particularly interested that from a lot of medical research and experience in the vast files of Mayo Clinic, it says, leaves of three, let them be. All right, so you want to make sure you get that part down. All right, on page 677, there's a section on foreign objects in the ear. And this is how you recognize if you have this problem. Pain in the ear, hearing loss, and particularly this last one, sensation of something present in the ear. And the diagnosis is that usually this is caused by something being stuck in your ear, and that you should have someone look in. Of course, it's very difficult to look in your own ear. And the prognosis is very good. All you need to do is have a physician take the foreign object out of your ear. Well, this isn't going real well, so let's just try one more here. How about on page 690? This is the section on protruding ears. And the symptoms are ears which project out an abnormally large distance from the head. And it explains here that those who have this can't hear any better than those that don't have this. I thought that was good. And it also tells you that it does not help, contrary to what your mother said, to tape them back at night, because that doesn't make a lot of difference in the morning. Now, there are a whole lot of other maladies that are far more serious and information that is far more significant. This morning we look at another reference book from home, and it is the Bible. And it, in places, has a layout that is somewhat similar. It talks about maladies, not of the body so much as of the soul, and talks about their symptoms and diagnosis and prognosis and treatment. It's interesting when you talk about the soul because the New Testament, at least, was written in Greek during the first century, and the Greek word for soul is psyche. In fact, the discipline for the study of the soul is technically called psychology, although in our generation it has taken on something of a different than original meaning. In this reference book, we look this morning at James 3, verses 14 through 16, and it is a section about an infection of the soul that has a name. It's called devil's wisdom. And there is listed here the symptoms of this infection of devil's wisdom, the diagnosis, the prognosis, the treatment. And it is a very serious disease of the soul. In fact, if it goes untreated, it is terminal. It results in death, not just for this life, but forever. So listen carefully. See if you, from the reference book, can pick out what are the symptoms and diagnosis and prognosis. If you harbor bitter envy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast about it or deny the truth. Such wisdom does not come down from heaven, but is earthly, unspiritual, and of the devil. For where you have envy and selfish ambition, there you find disorder and every evil practice. So there are two primary symptoms of devil's wisdom. They are bitter envy and selfish ambition. But even before getting into it, there's some warnings that come along with it. And they might be considered rather typical, but they are extremely important. So James 3:14 says, concerning these symptoms, do not boast about them. It's kind of a strange thing, the way we humans sometimes boast about the things that are wrong with us. That we can sit in a conversation and we can compare the illnesses and the surgeries and the medications that we have, almost as if somehow the more you have, the more superior you are, and those that don't have all of these things are somehow inferior, that they don't face these diseases or maladies. The Bible is saying that anyone who is inflicted with the infection of devil's wisdom should not boast about it. It is certainly not something to be proud of. And then the other piece of advice from the Bible is do not deny the truth. Sometimes we think that if there is something that is wrong with us, and especially if it's serious, that not thinking about it, not talking about it, not getting any help, just acting as if it's not there, somehow that will make it go away and that will steal from it the power that it has over us. The Bible's wisdom here is don't do that. Do not deny the truth if you find that you have the symptoms of devil's wisdom, because that would be a very dangerous thing to do. So we take a closer look. Symptom number one is bitter envy. Envy is a zealous internal passion concerning other people and relationships to them. It is an attitude toward other people. I think I like best a definition I once heard that said that envy is when you feel good about bad things that happen to other people and you feel bad about good things that happen to other people. So there is envy in the heart, for these are all symptoms of the heart. When you think of someone that you perhaps dislike or with whom you've had a rivalry or a bad experience and something terrible happens to that person, you think, ooh, that kind of makes me feel great. My kind of day. Or when something very good happens to that person, it sort of gets you depressed because you don't want anything good to happen as far as she's concerned or in his life. It's not a difficult symptom to see. Most people can quickly recognize it in themselves and in others. Bitter envy is, I suppose, an escalation of simple envy. Bitter envy has volatile feelings of emotional resentment. Whenever seeing or thinking of the person that we don't like, it's a bitterness that runs deep, sometimes because of what someone else has said or done, and so we could say there's a legitimate cause, although objectively from somebody else's point of view, it may not be as big a deal as we think it to be. But that bitterness is like a sore that festers inside of us until eventually it compounds with envy to do terrible things. It actually physically changes us. Mention that person's name or see it in print or hear somebody else talk about him, and the heart begins to pound and the blood pressure goes up. There's a tension and a stress to the voice. There's a frown that comes to the face. It's really a sad and and a painful symptom. It's, in a sense, this bitterness of the heart that some people harbor and carry for a lifetime. It is so self-destructive. You might compare it to the rust that can get into the metal of a car, and you're a little embarrassed by it. You don't want the rust in your car to show, and so you take a Saturday afternoon, and you scrape it down, you sand it off, you spray on some primer, you put on a finish coat. It's not perfect. It's not the way it was originally, but it looks very good, except the rust is deep in the metal. And give it a few weeks or months or a winter season, come next spring, and there will be bubbles on that paint and bubbles other places on the fender and maybe someplace else on the car where the rust that is underneath keeps pressing out and the paint that covers it up starts to crack and disappear until the rust shows for everyone to see. Bitterness. Bitter envy is a lot like that. That it ferments in the heart. It's a rust that can only so long be contained by a veneer or a paint until eventually it bubbles, it pushes its way through. The other symptom of devil's wisdom is selfish ambition. That describes the person who wants to get ahead more than to do right. The Greeks used that expression to describe politicians who wanted to get into office or wanted to hold office, and while they may have initially been principled, they will abandon their principles and do what is wrong in order to get what they are after. It, too, is a terrible symptom. A symptom that is sometimes more difficult to see in ourselves, although it can be done. We need to ask ourselves whether we are consumed by our own issues and our own problems. And the energy of life is primarily spent on getting ahead to where we want. What is the percentage of our vocabulary that is self-descriptive? And what is the percentage of our vocabulary that talks about the needs of other people and focuses outward rather than inward? It's asking ourselves the question, would I really tell a lie in order to get ahead? Would I do something dishonest in order to retain a job? Would I do something that I know to be wrong in order to get a contract that would really bring in the money and all the things the money can buy? There are actually some diagnostic tests for bitter envy and selfish ambition that are virtually foolproof. They can be self-tests, or they can be tests that others can help us with. The first of them, not quite as definitive as the second, is the talk test. Just talk for an hour about almost anything. For it is in our words that a window to the soul and to the heart is opened up. And so we listen to ourselves or a tape of that which we have said. We wonder, is there here a critical spirit? Is there here a bitterness that bubbles out? Is there an ambition that compromises what is truly right and what is genuinely good? Because talk usually is an adequate test to show whether the symptoms of bitter envy and selfish ambition are present. But if that test doesn't work, the second test, almost always will show. And that is the stress test. It is a test that God often uses in our lives to find out what is in our hearts and if there are infections that are contaminating our souls. For when life has little stress, the stuff of which we are made and the infections that we have are easily masked. But when there are too many things to do, when the pressure is on, when day after day things go wrong, when the choices of life seem to repeatedly be the wrong choices of life, and we just feel closed in until the stress is there, the symptoms show through. And when someone is under stress, when someone is up against it, when someone is in the most unpleasant of circumstances, and there is no sign of bitter envy or selfish ambition, that is a virtual guarantee that there is no presence of this infection that is called devil's wisdom. The prognosis, if the sin isn't cured, the diagnosis, where is it all going to go from the symptoms that we have seen? Well, that also is explained by this reference book, the Bible, because after the symptoms have been checked in verse 14, in James 3:15, it's time to decide the actual diagnosis. We're told that this wisdom, and the word here, wisdom, is put in quotes because it's really saying this is the way sin thinks. And sin is not necessarily something that is unattractive. It can be very attractive and can be very sophisticated. But one thing is for sure about it, and that is that it doesn't come from God. It doesn't come from heaven. That whenever there is bitterness, whenever there is selfish ambition, whenever there is envy, you know that those are things that God does not generate. They've got to come from someplace else. Because that's not who God is. And that's not what God does. Wisdom instead, that is the devil's wisdom, it comes from earth. It is unspiritual. It is of the devil. It's interesting when surveys check out the religious beliefs of America, that about 95% of Americans or more say they believe in God. A very high percentage say they believe in Jesus Christ. They believe in the Bible. But when questions are asked about the devil and whether the devil is a real being, a real person, the percentage drops significantly. I've never quite understood that, because the same Bible in which people affirm a belief is the Bible that tells about the reality of Satan as this great spiritual power and person that is so evil and so antagonistic to God. And those who say they believe in Jesus, when Jesus obviously believed in the reality of Satan, it seems to me to be a contradiction at best. Satan is a real and a powerful person who has waged spiritual warfare against God and against us. It's almost like bacterial warfare. You know, that's illegal by international treaty and standards, but every now and then in the press we hear a story that says that this country and other countries, in secret places, in out-of-the-way spots, retain arsenals of bacterial weapons and the delivery systems to infect huge populations with viruses and bacteria, with things like anthrax that will cause painful and terrible deaths of hundreds of thousands of people. It's illegal because it's so immoral, it's so inhumane. And yet, it is as if Satan has looked at God's creatures, all of us, and said, if I can get an infection in the soul that they will think as I think, instead of thinking as God thinks, then that will spread. That will get them. That will eventually destroy them. Well, I suppose it can be described in a lot of different ways, but the very essence of this devil's wisdom is the assumption that we can successfully live independent of God. And it is a pervasive infection. It is the mentality that says, look, I don't know what I'm facing this week, but I'm pretty good at this. I've done it before, I can do it again. In terms of money, sure, I know how to make money. In terms of winning in a relationship, hey, I'm a master at relationships. And I can do it all without God. I'm a smart person, I have a good education, I have experience, I have sophistication, I have all the things that I need in order to make it in life without God, when the truth of it is that we are really unable to do anything well without God. And when we buy into this wisdom, this false wisdom of Satan, it takes a cell of the soul at a time and spreads until we truly believe it and sometimes think ourselves to be healthy when we're sickest of all. You know, there are people who struggle for decades with being overweight. And then, with or without a diet, they start tipping the scales not quite so high. and are down 5 pounds, and then 10, and they think, wow, maybe I could lose the 25 pounds I've always wanted to lose. This is the best thing that's ever happened to me. And the weight continues to drop, and it's 15, and it's 20. And then 25 pounds, and you go out and celebrate and say, wow, at last I'm able to wear the size clothes I want to wear. Life is wonderful. So the 25 becomes 30, and 35, and 40. And then there is that day, the recognition, this is not something about a diet. This is not something that is good. This is something that is terribly, terribly wrong. And so it is with those that buy into a philosophy of life, a devil's wisdom, that somehow think that life can be successful without God, that sin can ever be good, that the things that we should not do are good things to do, and at the front end, it can be an experience of ecstasy, only to discover that as the devil's wisdom, like an infection, spreads through our souls and into our lives, that it is a wisdom that comes from earth and is unspiritual and is of the devil and is a terrible thing. And so the prognosis for it is bleak. If the disease isn't cured, if bitter envy is real and selfish ambition is present, if the diagnosis is right, if a person lives by the devil's wisdom rather than God's, James 3:16 says that where you have envy and selfish ambition, there you find disorder and every evil practice. That's just the opposite of what everybody expected. The assumption here has been, if I do it my way, if I do it without God, if I get the advantage of my ambition, then at last my life is going to be in order. Because getting our lives in order is kind of what we're all into. Having the right priorities and the right schedule and the things we want and everything kind of adjusted, the idea that that will bring then happiness, only to discover that when this is the devil's wisdom, life becomes far more disordered than ever it was before. It's an interesting line in 1 Corinthians 14:33 that says that God is not a God of disorder, but of peace. That does not mean that God gets every book on the shelves of heaven's libraries exactly right. It means that God has a way of bringing into a human life what he has done to the universe, an order, a discipline, a working together that is right, the way it was meant to be and designed in the first place. But just the opposite happens when life is lived by the devil's wisdom and without God. And the disorder results in every evil practice. That seems far-fetched at first, because we can hardly imagine that a little dishonesty here and some envy there and some selfish ambition on the side is ever going to spill over into the ugliness of the great dictators and assassins and people like Hitler of history. But it says every evil practice, recognizing that what we do at first contained in a piece of our lives that says, all right, I can have an inappropriate relationship at home, but it'll never affect the business principles by which I operate. Or at school, I may be able to cheat, but that does not mean that I'm going to cheat in the rest of my life. Only to discover that we are interconnected like all the systems of our physical bodies, and that this infection moves from one area to another until it starts to crumble. And what was wrong in marriage becomes wrong in family, and what's wrong in family becomes wrong in business, until all of health and everything else is affected. Evil starts in one place and shows up in many other places. And so the man who is a good guy at work but a bad guy at home becomes a bad guy everywhere. It's a disease that spreads. My, all of this seems terribly pessimistic. Once before having the Mayo Clinic medical book, I had another medical book. And when there was something wrong with me, I used to go and read the book, and it always depressed me. And so I finally came to a decision one day, and actually did this. sort of ceremonially walked out to the trash can and I threw the medical book away. And I felt better for years after doing that. You know, it was really a stupid approach. Throwing away the book isn't what it's about. It's dealing with the issues, the real issues of life. The Mayo Clinic Health Book concludes every section with treatment. I like that. I like that especially when they're matters of great disability and threatening death. It says that you should see this physician or that, or you might have a particular therapy recommended to you. Or this may require a type of surgery or certain medication. But in it there is hope, that there is an alternative to being sick, that there's a cure that can be prescribed. And so James 3, 14 through 16, this psychology book, this study of the soul, the human soul, that moves from symptoms to diagnosis and prognosis. Fortunately, and a gift from God, the great physician, also gives a treatment. There's a treatment. There's a cure. There's an alternative to living with envy and bitterness and selfish ambition and the devil's wisdom. And that cure, then, that prescription, is clearly written by God in James 3, verses 17 to 18. But time's up. Come back next week.
Friday night, John Just stayed up all night with some 2,000 junior high students. He's alive and well this morning and joins us. John, congratulations and welcome.
Thank you.
John Mark, measuring 21 inches long, weighing 9 pounds, 3 ounces, was born to William and Beverly Just. Now, the year of my birth, 1967, wasn't terribly significant, nor was the date, October 23rd, 7 years, 8 days after my sister was born, nor was the time, 2 p.m., You see, my mom had to finish the laundry before she would go to the hospital. I was born a half hour later. But rather, the significant circumstance that sunny afternoon was the family into which I was born. I was born into a family that surrounded me with Christian love, showed me the importance of a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, a family that allowed me to succeed, and a family that allowed me to fail. And for this, I'm eternally grateful. Thank you, Mom and Dad. From birth, I grew. I enjoyed my fair share of stitches and broken bones and soon found myself in junior high. It was during this time that I made a personal commitment to Jesus Christ. I became a Christian. I did so by acknowledging Jesus as my personal Lord and Savior, and reading the Bible became very important to me. Grades 7 through 12 were difficult and worst, but I endured. I was active in my local church youth group, in various extracurricular school activities, and I had a growing love for the out-of-doors. Graduation from Aiken High School led to college. I felt that some sort of business degree was the best way to make my imprint on society, so I chose the University of Minnesota at Duluth, partly for education, but mostly because Brett Hull skated for the Bulldogs. In retrospect, my college years provided little in the way of spiritual growth, something that makes my present commitment to God all the more precious to me. But my years at UMD were filled with a further love for the outdoors that took the form of hiking, cycling, fitness, and yes, climbing. Graduation again. With degree in hand, I set out to conquer the world, and I thought that I would be the first accounting major ever to receive a multi-year incentive-laden contract complete with signing bonus. What I got was a brief 8-month stint selling fine jewelry in downtown Minneapolis. From that point, I completed my requirements for the CPA exam and worked as an internal accountant in a firm. A geographic change brought me to South Minneapolis, and wanting to get connected into a church, I went asking friends and family for suggestions. My brother David suggested Wooddale Church, and so I began attending an evening Bible study led by Brian Christensen. During this time, my landlord and I engaged each other in many evening conversations. She was and is a junior high teacher, and often our talks centered about this age group. I became convinced through these conversations that I had no right to comment on any issues or any circumstances or anything that was going on in these young lives unless I was willing to become actively involved. So I sought out Greg Wiseman, the junior high pastor here at Wooddale, and he allowed me to become part of the volunteer staff for the 7th, 8th, and 9th grade programs. My goal for that first year was to impact one student positively for Jesus Christ. My level of involvement grew in the program, and I was soon contemplating thoughts of making ministry my vocation. After prayer and counsel, I attended Bethel Seminary in the fall of 1993. This past summer, I accepted the junior high associate position here at Wooddale. I continue to meet my goal of impacting students for Jesus Christ. My future is very, very bright, not because of who I am, but because of the God I serve, and I thank him for that. Tony Kurtz, a noted alpinist who died on the north face of the Eiger in the 1930s, said, "Never give one's life over to death." I agree with Kurtz, but wish to carry that idea just one step further. Give one's life over to life. I thank God for giving me life, salvation. I thank God for allowing me to serve him with my life. I can confidently agree with the statement, give my life over to life.
They don't understand that their materialism is inhibiting their growth. They're trying so desperately to enhance their lives that they're drowning in their own pleasures. There is no joy in their souls anymore.
I wish there was some way I could help them.
I want you to go down there. Talk to them. Help them find what they think they're seeking in their medications.
You mean meditations?
No, medications. They seem to be placing enormous value on rituals of medication, which they claim will prolong their life. I'd like you to check it out. I'll need a full report by tomorrow.
I'll leave immediately.
Oh, and shut the gate behind you.
Help! Help! I've been poisoned!
What? What did you take?
My wife poisoned me. I know it.
Are you sure? How long ago was it?
Well, we've been married 2 years next month.
No. What did you eat?
It was an old jar of picante sauce. It smelled funny. I should have known better.
Can you breathe?
Yes.
Have you taken any Ipecac?
Oh, wasn't necessary.
Okay, that's good. What else?
Well, I know she has a separate bank account.
Any rashes, blurred vision?
No.
I think maybe you've just had some bad salsa. Why on earth would she poison you?
Oh, well, ever since she got this promotion at work, her priorities have been totally skewed. She hasn't been home for dinner in weeks. I'm the one doing all the work. I'm home with three whining kids, two of whom are still in diapers. She never calls when she's going to be late. And now this. Oh, she doesn't even have the decency to let me die with dignity.
That doesn't make any sense, though. She has no reason to poison you.
Oh, she's making more money than me now. She looks at me so contemptuously like I'm a worm. It wasn't always this way, though. Oh, no. I used to be the main breadwinner in the family. I remember when she used to have to ask me for money.
Have you been under a lot of stress lately?
No, not really. Everything's fine. I'm fine. It's her. She's the one that's going crazy.
You know, it occurs to me that perhaps you have been poisoned, but not by your wife.
Really? Do you think she hired someone to do it?
It's you. All those bitter feelings inside you are poison. Systematically, they're destroying your faith, your trust, even your marriage.
Me?
You might try talking with your wife about this. She may not even realize how neglected you feel.
I suppose.
I wouldn't mention the word poison, though.
Well, you're right. If it was a mistake, well, she might take offense.
True.
But if I really were poisoned, and if it wasn't her fault, well, she might feel a great deal of sympathy for me. She might even stay home to take care of me.
Well,
just out of curiosity, do you have any...
No, don't even think about it. Talk to your wife.